STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
All right, friends. Greg Kokel here. Glad to have you on board for Stand to Reason. And I am going to do something a little different. This time around, I have some things to say by way of opening comments, but I'm going to set them aside for the moment because we have a caller that's been on for the last hour holding through my prior interview with Rod Rosenblatt, which many of you have already listened to. It was the last podcast and was on last week and didn't get on. So I'm going to go to Jeremy in Indianapolis right out of the chutes here. Jeremy, welcome, and thank you for your holding power. Wow.
Yeah, no problem. Did you say Indianapolis?
Right. Say that
okay,
again.
It's
wait,
Minneapolis.
It said Indianapolis. Did I say Minneapolis? Where are you at right now, Jeremy?
It's Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Oh, Minneapolis. Okay, great. Mini so-called. Got it. Okay.
That's right.
I'm actually going to be in Minneapolis coming in January. Did you know that?
I knew in February.
Maybe it is. Yeah, it's early in the year. It's when it's going to be really cold. That's what I know. So just so you're apprised of that, maybe you can come by and hang out with us or do that.
Yeah, I have to try to check it out for sure.
Okay, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I've had a question that I thought you might be able to help with, and I'll explain why as I go along.
All right.
So recently in my life, I just noticed different situations that cause me to get attention from other people.
Uh-huh.
So one of those things is I'm recently a leader for a large salsa group in this area. And
did you say a salsa group, like a dance group?
A social group.
Social.
Spending time together.
Okay.
Like that.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
I just saw this. Okay, go ahead. I just want to be clear. I mean, salsa's okay. I just wanted to be clear. Okay.
Salsa would be fun, though.
Yeah.
So I talked to the leader of this group, and he said that getting attention from others, especially people from, say, the opposite gender, is a common thing that happens being a leader of this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing that's been happening is I actually went to the Cross-Examined Instructors Academy a month ago.
Right.
And I released a blog post that week after and got a lot of people viewing it, and people would come up to me after and say, like, hey, it was a really good post, and then start talking about the topic, which is really cool, but also, you know, something that also kind of draws attention from people in terms of bringing things up in conversation and whatnot.
Yeah, right. And in other words, if you have written something that is meaningful to people, they're going to be thankful to you for it, and then they also will look up to you in some measure because of the quality of your contribution, and that may stimulate other questions or other interaction where they think you could help them with.
Right.
Kind of like what you're doing now on the radio show calling me.
That's, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the way that works. I agree. Okay.
Right. So then for me, it can be a challenge kind of getting attention in those different ways, because number one, I'm not used to it based on my past. And also, I can sometimes feel pressure from other people, like maybe having thoughts of, does this person like me? Like different thoughts I might have about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I've wrestled with the idea of how to glorify God in those situations.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it'd be good to talk to you about this because being at an event like CIA and kind of different church situations that you're in, you get people who want to talk to you kind of constantly throughout that time, from what I've noticed. So I don't know if this is something you've consciously have thought about, but I was wondering if you have any thoughts about that whole topic and maybe how you approach those situations.
Yeah, well, two things come to mind in general, and that is the impact on you that this attention that you're getting results in, and your impact on other people. Okay, so this is going two different directions. Okay, so let me say something about the impact on you. I know there's concern that you feel a little uncomfortable because you're not used to this, and secondly, you're not sure what else may be involved when people are paying attention to you. As your friend said, that this might be an opportunity for maybe other women to come on to you or something, if I understood you correctly.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Did you say you're single or married?
I'm single.
Yeah. Well, I was single for 48 years of my life. I became a Christian. I'm sorry. I got married just 4 days before my 48th birthday, which I had on my honeymoon. So I was definitely heavily involved in ministry. I was actually 5 years into Stand to Reason and 8 years into radio before I got married. So I was a single for a long time while in the public view, okay? And I guess there can be a liability in a sense of someone coming on to you or it wasn't so much, I don't know, if coming on is pretty aggressive. Man, it's been 20 years almost since I've been in the single scene, but there certainly is a sense that there are some people that might be paying attention to you for reasons other than the contribution that you're making in their lives spiritually. Now, that isn't necessarily bad, but it could create a compromising circumstance or an awkward circumstance if you're not sharing that opinion. My wife, when she found out that we were going to be introduced to each other on a kind of a blind date, listened to me on the radio and then came to a service where I taught, and she was in the audience. So she was checking me out in a certain sense to assess the quality of my character or whatever. And I don't think that that was a bad thing that she was doing. Actually, wisdom. There was wisdom in that, okay? However, it can be a little bit unusual if somebody is getting big eyes and then seeing you in a way that's not consistent with who you are as an individual. And it doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman or, you know, people in general can put you up on a pedestal in a way that's not healthy for you or themselves. So what you're describing could be a problem, depending. Now, what I tried to do is I tried not to feed that, okay? And I tried not to preen in a certain sense I was trying to be careful about drawing a lot of attention to myself. There was already a lot of attention. I didn't need to do that anymore. And I tried to be as transparent as I could before other people and be generous with them, okay? I think a person, if they're self-reflective, are aware when haughty thoughts or feelings arise in them. And when I mean haughty, when I say haughty, I mean something like, boy, aren't I something? Wow, I'm the star, or something like that. Man, when those feelings begin to rise up in people, and they are natural in the sense that they happen to just about everybody in a circumstance like that, that's when I have to say, sorry, Lord, I don't want that kind of thing. And I just have to have this internal dialogue with God and just kind of confess it and put it away and try to be genial and down-to-earth and pleasant with people and accessible and not act like I'm anything special, okay? So that's a discipline on my part to do that so I don't feed on that kind of thing that other people are giving. Now, the Scripture does say in Proverbs, it says something kind of interesting because there's two sides to the saying. It says, let another praise you and not your own lips. So it's telling you, don't praise yourself. Don't build yourself up. Don't draw attention to yourself. Look, if you're already in a position of somewhat of visibility and leadership, there's attention being drawn to you, and there's no reason to magnify that. That just makes things more difficult, okay? So don't praise yourself, is what the writer of Proverbs is saying. But it also says, let another praise you. It's don't you praise yourself, let other people do it, and let them. Now, I think what's going on there is that there are going to be people that are going to express genuine appreciation. And I know you've experienced that, Jeremy, from what you've told me. There's going to be genuine appreciation. You did something useful and helpful for them in their lives, and they're going to want to say thank you. That's not unnecessary in a hero worship. I mean, sometimes it could be, but it's not. That's in itself. It's not. It's just, wow, thank you. You did a great job at that. I appreciated the comments, the insight, the delivery, the talk, whatever it is they're saying to you they liked. Okay, now some people are going to go, oh, shucks, don't tell me that. It's all God and none of me and stuff like that. I don't think that's helpful. I don't think that accomplishes what the Bible is asking for. I think that when somebody gives you a genuine compliment, the best thing to do is receive it in a generous way. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks. So what you're doing is you're receiving the gesture in a polite fashion. You're not putting it down by trying to reject it. Oh, it was all God. No, it wasn't all God. Your lips were moving, right? So God was involved, but so were you. And if there is no merit, in a sense, that accrues to any of your efforts, then why is God going to give you rewards for what you did? Clearly, there is merit. And when people see the meritorious element, they show appreciation for it, and there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that. As long as we don't, as the saying goes, let it go to our heads. So I think my standard is when people say something nice to me, I just accept it. I thank them for it, and then move on. Appreciate that. That's really nice of you to say that. I'm so glad to hear that God used it like that in your life, or something to that effect. You can mention God. You don't have to mention God every time. You know, I think people pretty much know in Christian environments, yeah, God's at work here. And as long as you know that, that's what's important. Let another praise you, but not your own lips. Okay, so there's that part. All right. And if you start getting out of line, like you start getting a big head about stuff, well, I'll tell you, in my personal situation, God dealt with that in my life a number of years ago, probably 30 years ago now, and it was not fun. It lasted for about 2 years of me getting my butt kicked by God. And that had the effect. I didn't understand at the time what was going on, but it had the effect of changing my attitude about that kind of thing. So if somebody says, hey, you're a rock star, I'm going to say I'm not a rock star. I'm your brother in Christ, all right? I'm glad to make a contribution. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm just one of you guys. Get it? That's what I tell them, okay? So now that's the half of, like, what's going on inside of you. Then there's the other half going on inside of them, which I address a little bit when I say I'm not a rock star. I'm just, you know, and this is why I don't give autographs. People want me to sign their Bibles, you know, or I tell them I don't sign a book I didn't write. I'll sign a book that I did write. There's a convention to that, but I don't give autographs. But I have to explain to them. I said, look, you know, I'm sorry. I really don't believe in this because I don't want the celebrity status. I don't think it's appropriate for Christian workers to encourage that. Is that okay with you? I don't mean to hurt your feelings. I know where you're coming from. It's a good thing, but is that all right? I say that to them, and they always say it's okay. Now, the only time I have a weak spot is when it's like a six-year-old who is not going to understand the point I just made, so I just sign off on that usually. But you see what I'm going for there, Jeremy.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what about other people? Now, I think my ability to have an influence on other people is a stewardship. So if I know that I'm surrounded, I have people in my presence that are looking up to me, I take that as a sobering responsibility. So at Stand to Reason, we have this thing called the weighty word. And the concept of the weighty word is that insofar as people look up to me, I have I have the ability, there's a adjective I'm looking for, the proportional ability to have an impact in their life. That is, the more they look up to me, the greater the impact I can have in their life with the same amount of effort. Okay? So if people look up to me a little bit and then I show them, I compliment them on something, well, they'll appreciate that. That'll be nice for them. If they look up to me really, really lot, then when I give the same compliment, it has a much more leveraged impact on their life, okay? It becomes more weighty. So knowing that, that when I say something generous or gracious or show attention or give kindness to a person, because of the way they view me, whether rightly or wrongly, it's going to have a leveraged impact for good. That's a stewardship. That's like money in my pocket. How am I going to spend this money? I want to do it. People say, thank you so much for going out of your way to do this kind of thing. Well, in my mind, it was kind of a small thing that I did, but it had a big impact on them. So, wow, that's leverage, all right? So you get the concept. The more people look up to you, the greater is your leverage for you to have an impact for good with a small thing, all right? Now, so that I think about that in my involvement with, people at events, but I also think about that with other people in my life. You know, your kids look up to parents. And so there's a greater ability for a parent to have a powerful impact on the child when the child looks up to the parent. This is especially true of younger kids. When they get more teenagerish or young adultish, then that equation gets distorted a little bit. They don't want to hear from their parents, you know, whatever, for a season at least. But nevertheless, there's a leveraged impact. Now, keep in mind that same process, the weighty word, works in reverse as well. That is, people will respond with a greater impact proportionate to the how much they look up to you for good or for ill. So if you say something untoward, if you're unkind, if you're short, if you're snippy, whatever, to a person, where in the rank and file of people you don't know and they don't know you, this doesn't matter very much. But when you're in a position of respect with other people, this can have a huge impact for bad, not good. And you can probably imagine circumstances when people said, gee, you know, I was a Christian until I found out what my pastor was doing on the side. Well, why did it matter what their pastor was doing? Because they looked up to their pastor. And when he fell a long way in their minds, and that hurt their own convictions. And so this is why when I'm on my best behavior, when I'm around other people and I'm working really hard to measure my words, weigh my words, so they cannot be considered untoward, that nothing I do could potentially hurt another person's feelings, because if I hurt their feelings, it's going to hurt really bad. Get my drift there?
Yeah.
So it's a good habit to be in, you know, because it means you want to be on your best behavior, generally speaking, but it becomes more important when you have influence. And as God has given you influence, you can do things to protect yourself from not using that influence in the wrong way and not having it influence your own self-perspective, your own attitude, in a way that's not virtuous. That was the first couple things I talked about. But you can also use that influence as a stewardship to build people up in a weighty way, leveraged, but you need to be careful that it works in reverse as well. So I don't find influence to be a bad thing. I find it to be a good thing. But it can be used for bad in our lives, right, and in the lives of others. Does that help you?
Yeah, I think it puts a lot more concrete ideas onto the topic, rather than just the general fear of attention.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I definitely want to listen back to what you said and
good.
Kind of take notes on some of those things.
Yeah. And think about this, and this doesn't apply to you quite as much because you're single, but the most important people in our lives are our family members, our brothers, our sisters, our children, our spouses. And those are the people that it is hardest, I think, for a whole host of reasons, to give our best to, but they're the ones who deserve our best, and they're the ones that are most easily injured when we don't give them our best. But they are also the ones that are most positively impacted when we do. So that's just a reality of life. I'm just going to, if the shoe fits, wear it, you know. All right, Jeremy.
All right, thanks a lot.
I'm so glad we got a chance to talk. Thank you for your call. Let's take a break. And, we got a lot of folks on board, so I think I might skip my commentary today and just move on to you guys. You're more interesting than I am anyway, at least to me. Look forward to talking to you after this.
Do you have a friend, family member, or coworker who identifies as gay or lesbian? Or do you find yourself in conversations about the topic of homosexuality and want to make a productive contribution? Well, if you're either of these people, chances are you're wondering how to navigate those conversations and how to navigate those relationships in a healthy way, but without compromising your convictions. Well, I want to tell you about a new resource I've made called The Truth About Homosexuality, A Compassionate Response. And it's a DVD that includes the most comprehensive presentation of my teaching on this topic that I've ever presented. In this DVD resource, I'll present the truth about what scripture and science says about this topic of homosexuality, but also show you how to communicate it in a persuasive yet winsome and gracious manner. So I hope you'll consider this resource to help you elevate your understanding of this topic and make your conversations with friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian to become more Christ-like.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come and speak at a location near you? Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To schedule Greg, Alan, or Tim, send an email to Melinda or Darcy. To learn more, visit str.org/training/speakers.
I kind of like this. Is that it? Just that riff? All right. Good. I guess I should get back to my job here, huh, instead of listening to the music. That was really nice. All right, Greg Kokel here. Did you enjoy that, folks? That was kind of nice. And the show is Stand to Reason, and I'm just going to go right back to the callers since I have so many wonderful callers waiting on hold. In California somewhere is Sandy. Sandy, that's a great name for a Californian, especially a Southern Californian.
Thank you. That is true. I hadn't thought about that before.
Glad to talk to you today.
Well, on the note of your last call, I did want to thank you so much for your STR ministry. My faith has grown so much from listening to your podcast and reading the blog and different articles, and I've been able to find so much information on your website that has helped me answer a lot of my kids' questions. So
well, that's good. And we are working hard daily to make that website better. And we got big plans that will be rolling out next year, early next year probably. But I'm thrilled to hear that, and we can get even better. That's all I'm saying.
That's great. Great news. Well, I'll get to my question. I heard you mention Randy Alcorn's book, Heaven, on a previous podcast, and it sounded great. So I bought the book, and I think it's fantastic. And it got me thinking about a question I've had before, but I haven't researched, so I thought I'd ask your thoughts.
Okay.
In the book, he describes the present or the intermediate heaven as a waiting place until Christ returns and our bodily resurrection versus the eternal heaven or the new earth where we'll live forever with God and other Christians.
Mm-hmm.
So that got me thinking about the Bible's references to hell and Sheol and Hades, the abyss, and Gehenna. So my question is, what are the differences between these places, and are they comparable, like he mentions, to the present heaven versus the eternal heaven?
Well, we're in the middle, Tim Barnett and I, of a series through Solid Ground on the issue of hell, making the case for eternal torment, because this is being challenged now. And the case, to some degree, hinges on the definitions of some of these words and what is entailed in our understanding of those words. The first edition of that just came out a couple of days ago. So if you receive our Solid Ground, you will have received it already. Or if you're getting it in snail mail, it'll be in your mailbox shortly. I got mine the first day because I get mine electronically. First of all, I'm just trying to. There's some ambiguity about all of these things. Let me just say that, which is why there's difference of opinion among Christians. And I haven't read Randy's book thoroughly. Probably when I get older and I get closer to going to heaven, I'll give it more attention. It's just not. I've had glances through it. I know it's really well received by so many people, and he covers a lot of ground. And so I'm just going to trust his characterization of the intermediate state as opposed to the eternal heaven. I think what is simply meant there is that there is a place that we go, so to speak, to be with God, but it's not our permanent residence. It's intermediate in the sense that it is before we get our resurrected bodies and then take up our residence in our more permanent location in the new heavens and the new earth, however that's ultimately construed, okay? And what I've seen Randy do with most of that stuff has been impressive, okay? I think it's a great resource. With regards to hell, I think you're going to have, and I'm just using this in the broadest sense, that is, those who die apart from Christ being held for the time of judgment in which they will then go to their final disposition, okay? And there seems a necessity there also to have at least two kinds of states, and that is the state prior to the resurrection and the condition after the resurrection, because all will be raised from the dead, all right? And Daniel makes reference to this towards the end of the book, I think Daniel 12 or something like that. And then there's more reference in the New Testament, particularly in the book of Revelation chapter 20, all raised from the dead. And then there'll be a final judgment, and we see Jesus talking about that in Matthew 25. So I think in very general terms, it's appropriate to talk about two different states, that is, the state after one dies but before this general resurrection, and the state after the final judgment. And I think that would correspond probably with Randy Alcorn's two states in heaven. You have a similar situation on the other side of the grave, distinguishing those who died without Christ in perdition and those who died with Christ and in grace. Okay, are you with me so far? Okay. Now, the conditionalists, that is, the people who do not believe in eternal torment, for them, the final disposition is going to be annihilation. Although some might say there is a period of punishment and then annihilation. The final disposition is annihilation, ceasing to exist. So in that view, ultimately, everyone on the bad side, the goats in Jesus' illustration or parable in Matthew 25, the goats cease to exist, and that's God's eternal destruction. He destroys them, and they are destroyed forever. That's what they mean by eternal destruction, annihilation. Okay? What happens before? Well, there may be an abode where they are consciously alive or aware, not alive in the physical sense, but they are consciously aware, similar to what you see in the telling. I don't know if it was a parable or an account, the telling by Jesus of the rich man and Lazarus. You know, some say, well, that's a description of something that's happening. It's not a parable. Even if it were a parable, though, it would have to mean something in particular. And it seems minimally, it means that the people who die outside of the grace of God are conscious and in torment. I mean, I don't know how else you could take that, even if it's a parable.
Right.
All right. So, and there are believers then who are not in torment, but they are in comfort, Abraham's bosom, in that particular example. So, so some will say, who believe in the conditional immortality, I mean, conditional mortality, conditional immortality, the annihilationists, that's who I mean, will say, some will say, well, you're kind of in a holding pen, like county jail, until the final judgment, and then you go and you get annihilated. Some will say, no, you're sleeping, soul sleep, which means your soul is not aware at all until you wake up for the judgment, and then maybe you get annihilated. And others will say, you don't sleep, strictly speaking, you just cease to be, because they don't believe in the soul, they're physicalists, and so what happens is the physical body is you. When the body dies, then you disappear, and you are recreated for the judgment, and then you are snuffed from existence again as an act of judgment by God. I think some of those have problems with them, but I'm just trying to give the distinction between them. Now, in my view, there is a conscious state for the damned that they are in torment, until the final judgment, when their bodies are raised and they stand before the throne, and they are judged by Jesus according to their deeds and found wanting, and that are cast in the lake of fire that was prepared for the devil and his angels. And since the devil and his angels and the beast, etc., are tossed in there, and they are tormented forever and ever, that's in Revelation 20 and also Revelation 14, I believe, then those who are thrown in there with them experience the same fate. That strikes me as the very straightforward sense of those passages. And what Tim and I have said regarding that, even though people will look in the Old Testament and say, well, look at this doesn't seem to indicate that they suffer, they're just destroyed, etc. Our point is the last word is the last word. So whatever is going on in the book, in the Old Testament, and even things that may be ambiguous in the way Jesus states things, though I don't think he is ambiguous, the last word is the book of Revelation, and that's crystal clear. And so that's the last word. In light of progressive revelation, we learn more as time goes on through the subsequent revelation. The book of Revelations is the last revelation, and therefore it's the last word on what happens, and that is eternal torment, which is not a pretty picture, of course. And I don't like
right.
the idea, and I'm not comfortable being the champion of eternal torment, but this is what it amounts to. So with that scenario in mind, you have different words like hell and Hades and Sheol and Gehenna
mm-hmm.
that are brought into play. Now, I'm doing more work on the second response, or the second installment of the article on hell. It's called Hell Interrupted, and Tim and I are working on this together. He's actually done most of the heavy lifting in terms of research. I'm doing the organization and crafting it and wordsmithing it, you know, from the writing perspective. But we share our theological opinions about this. So Gehenna, as I understand it, is a word that the people there understood. Jesus used the fiery Gehenna and it was a description of the dump outside of the city where refuse was burned. Okay, and they threw their garbage there and they just burned it up. And so they're always throwing garbage on it, and that fire was always burning. And so there was a kind of a certain sense by the people of the perpetuality of the burning of the fires in Gehenna, because you're always dumping garbage on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when Jesus says, where the worm does not die and the fire does not go out, he's using a picture that they have of something physical to characterize an eternal condition, which he has tried to capture in this physical picture. The reason the fire does not go out in hell, which is the place where this ultimately takes place forever, is because that which it burns continues to burn. Okay? Fires that do not have fuel go out. And so if humans are annihilated, they are no more. It doesn't make any sense to call the fire an eternal fire. Or to say, in which Jesus is a language Jesus uses, or to say where the worm does not die and the fire does not go out. It's because there's always something there that is burning, so to speak, and that is those being tormented by the fire under the everlasting judgment of God. And for people to say, well, that means, oh, it's eternal in the sense that the consequence is eternal. I have never heard anybody refer to capital punishment as eternal punishment just because the person who's executed is dead forever. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right.
That doesn't make common sense of the language there, okay? So that's Gehenna. Hades, I think, is a Latin term that is meant to be a synonym for the word hell or possibly for Sheol. But Sheol was, it actually has a dual meaning. It is, generally speaking, the place of the departed souls. So when you die, you go to the grave, also known as Sheol. So everyone, in one sense, who dies goes to Sheol, okay? The problem is the word Sheol also has another nuance, and this comes out lots of times when you read it being referenced, that you don't want to go to Sheol because there's nasties that happen in Sheol. This is a bad place to go because people are tormented and punished in Sheol, and you will be rewarded with Sheol if you do the wicked stuff. So in a certain sense, Sheol is the place of the dead, and that's expressed in a neutral way, the grave, but it is frequently used as a place of terror and torment that you don't want to go to, because that place of the dead for the departed wicked is a place of torment. So though that's the way I would cast those words out now. Some are synonyms and some are related, but they are nuanced in a different way to tell us different things.
Okay.
All righty.
Great.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yes, you're welcome, Sandy. I appreciate the call, too. You know, and I was glad to kind of showcase that material that Tim and I are working on. And I realize, as some have pointed out, whose view we are attempting to critique, that we didn't answer all the questions in part one. That's why it's part one. Part two is coming. And actually, this is going to be a three-part series, but we are going to release part two and part three pretty much simultaneously. So you're going to get Through Solid Ground, the second part, but we need another part, another issue of Solid Ground, so to speak, to cover the ground that needs to be covered in light of the critical nature of this. And I mean critical in both senses of the word. It's critical, important, and it's critical, that is, there are critics of the classical view that we need to answer. Okay, but what we will do is deliver that digitally to you, make it available online so you can get the three-part series without having to put up with 6 months of Solid Ground talking about hell. All right, so that's the idea there. All right, I'm just going to keep going here instead of the commercial because I want to talk to some of you and not leave you in the lurch. Tim in Missouri. Tim.
Hey, Greg. This is Tim. Formerly from your neck of the woods up in the Chicago suburbs.
Oh, really? Okay. Good for you.
So we moved to Missouri, my family. I have kind of a long story, but I'll try to make it really concise.
Okay.
I have six kids. Three of them are biological boys, and three of them are adopted girls, all biological sisters from Peru.
Wow.
And
okay. By the way, are the girls harder than the boys in raising them?
Well, we almost have been raising two different families.
I see. Okay. Some tell me that the boys are harder at first because they're so rambunctious, but then they settle down. And the girls are easier at first, but then they break daddy's heart. So, you know, and I think my girls are getting harder, actually, for me, to be honest with you. But anyway, maybe other people have a different. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
So the girls, as I said, they were from Peru, and we adopted them when they were 9, 10, 11. So we didn't have the early years.
Yeah, that's harder.
And they are they're older than our boys, but they are kind of mentally a little bit not as mature.
Immature.
And
said.
The middle girl has fetal alcohol effect, and they've all had a little bit of fetal alcohol issues.
I see.
But for the most part, growing up, they were really good until we moved to Missouri about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's a combination of cultural things in Columbia, Missouri, where we live, and maybe their early years. But they got involved. Each one of them has left at one time or another due to a boy. The two older ones eventually came back, and we forgave them.
Wait, go back. I missed one part. You said one time or another they all left to be with a boy. Is that what you said?
Not a single. I should. Yeah, I'm a little nervous. So,
no, that's okay. You're doing fine.
The oldest sister first. Once she got to college, she immediately, even though we raised her in church and you know, et cetera, but as soon as she left for college, she had had issues with lying with us anyway. But when she got to college, the boyfriend that she had kind of joined up with prior to the end of her senior year and through the summer, did not go to college like he was supposed to, and then end up just kind of following her to her college. And
they're carrying on together is what it looks like.
Yeah, they started doing things that we did not approve of.
Right, I got it.
And she eventually left, and after her first year, she came back to live with his mother and father. Hmm. And we've had a lot of issues with Columbia parents being okay with their boys essentially shacking up with our daughters.
Yeah.
Even though we don't approve of it.
Right.
And
the
middle girl did not something.
I'm sure that's not just Columbia. I think that's not just Columbia. There's probably most places in the country are like that. But in any event, go ahead.
Yeah. So she eventually felt bad and did come back, and we had some stipulations. But she has gone on and really improved her life, and she became a Marine, and she's really kind of done a 180 and really repented of that.
Wow, that's good news.
The second daughter, she's the one that has some mental disabilities, and she came back within a couple weeks. But she even called due to the mother that the mother of the boyfriend had called the police on us. It was a really bizarre thing. So we were very angry with that situation.
Yeah.
And then the final daughter, they're all a year apart. Final daughter, towards the end of her senior year, she also got involved with a boy who was very hands-on, and they were doing stuff in my basement that we found out about.
Yeah.
And I told her she's not seeing him anymore. And
how old is she?
Now she is 20.
Okay, but she was living with you at the time, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And as I said, they're all kind of like a year or two.
Right.
In grade level, they're a year or two behind, and mentally, they're a year or two behind as well. And the youngest,
still 20 is a de facto adult, even though someone who's a slow 20 is still 18 or 17. Okay, got it.
Right. So bringing it to the final daughter, she, towards the end of her senior year, we had disapproved of the boy and things were going on. And she eventually four times had left our house to go live with that boy.
Wow.
And would come back. We talked to the school because the mother actually works at the school that she goes to.
Mm-hmm.
And so we.
The
we
boy's mother.
Kind of legal action.
The boy's mother, you mean, right?
The boy's mother.
Okay.
She's not a teacher, but in some kind of administrative capacity.
Yeah, right.
So we thought that was highly unethical. And so I went and talked to the principals. I didn't talk to the mother. And then the next weekend, she came back.
Okay.
So suffice to say, we went through a lot of issues towards the end of her senior years, but then I had a very long talk about how those girls ended up being in America and what our purposes were for adopting, kind of a James 1:27, you know, pure religion is this kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
And in our whole, you know, I'm kind of a philosophical person, so I was explaining to him the whole meaning of life in about a two-hour session. And
so,
he he purported to understand what I was saying and then said he was sorry. She didn't say she was sorry, but anyway, at the end of that evening, we said, we're going to do a complete reset, and you can come to our house under supervision. And even though I didn't really want him because he's not a Christian, my daughter had said she was, and she had been baptized, but now I have doubts about that. But anyway.
So you're going to do the reset.
Behind her back, he was going to go to this certain junior college, and she was following him in every single respect. And so she was going to go to this junior college. Now, when this was all going on, I said, I'm not helping you go to the same college as him. But after we did kind of a reset, I eventually gave in and helped her with her college stuff. And took her there. And
so how can I help? How can I help you in this situation? Do you think?
Okay, so I'm kind of rambling. So I'm sorry. So kind of with the 1 Corinthians 5:11 view of things, where my daughter was supposedly Christian.
Yeah.
The line in there says, "Don't even eat with such a one if they're guilty of sexual immorality and such."
Yeah.
Well, my daughter, at the end of that senior year, behind her back, she was getting an apartment with that guy, and I said, "If you're going to do that, then you might as well just leave." So she did leave for the final time. And we have not seen her since.
There have been
some texting, and she texted her sister and her older sister and basically doesn't claim us as parents anymore. She reverted to her Spanish last name. And there were some other issues with my oldest daughter was going to get married, and she got really mad about that. And then she ceased talking to us.
Okay, so I can do what?
So my question is I'm trying to find out whether it may be too late, it's been a year, but I'm trying to see if I handled it correctly. And I didn't push her away, but I don't know what the proper thing to do with her as far as contacting her now, since she doesn't want to have anything to
do with us. Okay, a couple of thoughts quickly here, and that is, for one, I'm just going to make an obvious statement. You cannot control what other people do. Even your own kids, especially when they're adults, all right?
Right.
You just can't control it. It's hard enough when they're in your home and you have a little bit more leverage, but ultimately you make your investment of prayer and effort, discipline, guidance, guidelines, wisdom, all of the above, and then then you let the chips fall, and there's not much you can do about that. Human beings are individuals, and who knows what drives any other individual. We have a fairly good sense of what drives us, but I think lots of things are going on inside of us that we don't get. So that's the first thing, you know, and I think about my own daughters, you know, in the long haul, you know, what's becoming of them? What will they be like? What will happen? Will they be faithful to the Lord? Will they live out the kind of values that we try to instill in them? We don't know. We do what we can, and we trust them to the Lord, and then, you know, and that's it. So that's the one thing. Now, secondly is, you know, you talked about the 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and there certainly is a principle there for the body of Christ. Sometimes that principle is a hard time playing out, treating the believer who's living in sin like a non-believer. It's hard to live that out when you have dueling responsibilities, like being a parent to a child. Okay, now, if a child, that means when your daughter, your offspring is what I mean, not like children, but offspring. If your daughter decides she doesn't want to have anything to do with you, well, she shuts the door and it's locked from the inside. There's not much you can do. You can knock on occasion, and I think it's appropriate to do that because, after all, she's your daughter. And remember, it's God who pursued us, and so it is Christian in the best sense of the word, in the deeply theological sense, for us to seek reconciliation when we are able. Or another way of putting it is to have our door open, unless it has to be shut on our side for some other reason. We have a wayward child who is deeply influencing the morals of other children in our home or something like that. But when you have somebody who's just saying, I'm out of here, you know, I think it's a good idea to keep the door open and every once in a while to knock on their door to see if they'd open, all right, and pursue that. And if they're living like a non-Christian, it is most likely they are a non-Christian. So you're treating them as an unbeliever, but unbelievers we're supposed to be involved with so that we might have a salutary impact on their life. And so I think that if your daughter's not a believer as in virtue of her behaviors, then continuing to reach out to her can be good. So there's a balancing act that I don't know if you did everything right, Tim. I don't have all the details. These are very difficult things to assess. Shoulda, woulda, coulda kind of thing. We can always say that kind of deal. And I look back at my own life. Somebody said once, regarding your life, they have no regrets. I cannot imagine such a person. You look back on your whole life, you have no regrets. You are out of touch with reality, anybody who says that. Because there are all kinds of things that I've done in my life. I'm just a normal human being. All kinds of things I regret. I regret things I did in the last 24 hours, for goodness sake. You know, so we all bring a mixed bag to the table, to our parenting, to our marriage, to our friendships. It's always a mixed bag, okay? And that we just have to do what we can by the grace of God, and then let the chips fall. I don't know what you might have done differently. But I think at this point right now, if your daughter shuts the door on you and she's not going to open it, then let her be. Every once in a while, I'll give a knock and make sure your door remains open. So that's the best advice I can give you under the circumstances, okay? I hope that helps, Tim. I got to run to some other callers here. So let's talk with Aaron in Renton. Okay, there's my buttons. There we go. Aaron in Renton, Washington. Renton, I think my sister used to live in Renton, Washington.
Yeah, you've told me before.
Oh, okay, same guy. All right, great. Sorry, all right. So what's on your mind?
That's
Aaron,
all right.
Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Greg. At first, I got to say thank you for the story of reality. That was a fantastic read. I actually read it in two sittings.
Wow.
So I couldn't do it in one. I had some work to do, but two sittings, one day.
Wow.
Which beat out Mere Christianity by one sitting. I read that in three sittings.
Wow.
So, thank you for that book. I actually bought two of them, one so I could lend out and one keep for myself, because I know I've lent things out and not gotten them back.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get two this time.
You want to guard all your precious markings on the book. You want to make sure you keep those. You can lend out the one that you didn't mark. Well, I'm very flattered
exactly.
by what you said. Thank you. Thanks so much. Glad to hear
that.
Yeah,
of course. Well, my question is, I guess, regarding your book. I had the pleasure and the challenge of giving a message or a sermon, I guess, and I chose to use your book. I kind of tried to condense it down to about a 35-minute message and presented it to the youth at our most recent youth camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that on Friday night a couple weeks back, and wanted to share with you that the youth pastor afterwards came up to me and said there were four young boys that all came up to him and asked if they could, you know, ask Jesus into their heart
mm-hmm.
or some variation of that. So I thought that was very cool
yeah.
and wanted to pass it along that there were four kids that were that I know of that were very touched by your material. So,
wow. That's great.
Yeah. So my question is, I was trying to anticipate questions in preparing for this, and I actually tried to call a few weeks ago, but
okay.
I guess you were doing interviews and whatnot. My question is, I'm trying to think of the best way to put it, and I've heard this question. You've answered this the reverse, so I'm going to try and put it a different way. How could Jesus, with a finite time on earth, pay for all of humanity? You talk about how he lived the perfect life and then he made a trade. In that trade, in that exchange, his life for ours, how could Jesus in this finite time pay for, I guess, what has been deemed or what others would say or asked is the kind of the idea that, you know, the crime and the punishment. So we in a finite time
right.
have committed sin, but we have an infinite punishment. So the inverse of that or the flip of that.
Right.
Is how could Jesus,
I get you. How can he? Right.
You know what I'm saying? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, we don't have an infinite punishment. We have an everlasting punishment. You will never live for an eternity. It's maybe a small point, but here is the heart of your question. I think is answered by, I should say, this question points to the necessity of the God-man making the sacrifice. Only, as I point out in the book, only man is responsible for paying the debt, but only God is capable of paying the debt. I think if it was just a normal human being, it's not possible to make sense of the notion that a normal human being suffering in a finite amount of time can pay a price that would accomplish the redemption and forgiveness of people who otherwise would have been paying forever and ever. It's like the calculus doesn't work. But this is why the God-man, where you have one person, two natures, you have fully man and fully God, there is a qualitative element to this. The scripture doesn't go into a lot of detail on this, or maybe even any, but when you think about why the God-man, this seems to be part of the answer, because arguably the divine human being, that is the God-man Jesus of Nazareth, is capable of accomplishing in his divinity the kind of thing that no man could accomplish in his humanity. That is, he accomplishes a qualitative act that provides an adequate payment that would cover the punishment any individual would have to pay for themselves with everlasting torment. Not an infinite torment, but everlasting. That is, it just keeps going and going and going. And it never accomplishes an infinity, is kind of the point I'm making. So what I'm drawing on here, and this is like a mind-blowing concept, but I think one of the reasons why God became a man was to be able to do for mankind what no mere human could do. He could stand in proxy for mankind and suffer in a way that purchased redemption for all of those who would put their trust in him. And even if it's one person, you're still looking at one person who would have been punished in an everlasting fashion that is compounded by all the population of the elect, so all the people who would trust in Jesus. And, wow, that's mind-blowing. But this is why we needed the God-man. I think that's the best explanation, answer to your question. And I thank you for it, Aaron. Gave you the short trip there because we're out of time, as the music shows. Thank you for the call, and thank you for the rest of you joining with me in this hour that we spent together. It was fun. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.